first of all, congratulations on the film, which is lovely, transforming, informative, passionate, and beautiful.
Thank you very much, Lucre.
How did you get those performances out of those kids?
Well, I think what it was I just allowed them to play, you know. It was by keeping things light on the set, really, I suppose. But they were genius actors, and sometimes Emma did things, and I thought she was over the top, and I would say, you know, Emma, I think you should take it down. She'd say, do you think so, Jim? And I'd be, yeah. But when I'd go to the edit, and she'd turn out to be right. So it was one of the first times in my life that actually happened to me.
Did she know she was working with a great Jim Sheridan?
She could care less. She was like, she cast it, actually. She insisted that I cast her sister. And her sister told me to stop cursing on the first day of shooting. And so I was like, okay, I'm not going to stop cursing. I said, I don't think that will happen. I don't want to lie to you kids. So I said to them, they could say action and cut, and that's how we did the film. So maybe that helped, that they felt like totally in control.
Bonner, let me ask you, at what point did you see the film, and how did you decide to co-write the song for it?
Well, you know, we're mates as well as colleagues here. There's a whole community of us in Dublin, artists and painters and writers and filmmakers, and we all hang out in each other's hair and shout and whisper into each other's ears over, you know, the din and clatter of glasses and babies crying and drinks spilt. And so I've heard the story a long time before I got to see the early cuts. Jim wasn't even sure about a song. It was Gavin Friday and Maurice Caesar who'd done the score that said they felt it needed some sort of resolve. And we found a way where we used the main theme. That's the key to this song, is it comes out of the main theme of the score. And so that's why it doesn't feel like an add-on.
But the lyric presence, it does feel right there. I'm not sure it's a resolve or anything. It just kind of...
Actually, it's not a resolve. You know what it might do? It just holds the note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The last speech of the child. What is the full last speech?
Says,
like right up to the very end.
She says, if you still got a picture of me in your mind, well, that's like the picture I want to have of Frankie, the one that stays in your mind forever. So you go back to reality, and I'll ask Frankie to please, please let me go.
So that's the note. It's very hard to go after that. It's the most, you're just sitting in your seat. Mm-hmm. You can't move. You can't breathe.
Yeah.
And what Andrea Corr did was with her voice, became that child, really. She actually just, which is very clever of her. And that's why it feels like it's holding the note. And then the lyric is obtuse. I don't even remember writing the lyric. In fact, we just found out yesterday why I don't remember. Because nothing interesting. It was never written down. I called it in over the phone. And to Gavin, and he wrote it down. Mm-hmm. And she sang this in one take and get his little home studio in the toilet, because that was their vocal booth. And it was at the size of a phone booth.
And that's the track?
Mm-hmm. One year.
There's not even two takes, was there?
No, one take. Mm. She said, I can't sing this again. And we're saying, well, maybe you should, you know. And she said, really, she'd put so much into it. It's very tender. Very proud. She's a really, really special singer.
Yeah. And, you know, she's one of those singers that, you know, she's in this decors in Ireland, and they do stuff that's very deceptive. It's kind of seems light, but it's deceptive kind of music. And
they're like the Carpenters.
Yeah.
It's designed by Versace.
Jim, you gave this guy his break early on. Can you tell me? At least your publicist claims this.
Well,
I don't know what your publicist would claim, Bono, but...
Well,
you had a theater. You had a theater in Dublin.
Yeah.
Who's paying you?
Well, I did. I had a place called the Project Art Centre where we did, like, Wim Wenders films and Fassbinder, and we put on mad art exhibitions, and we had the theater. And then at night, after the shows, we used to have a Friday night slot. And then I don't know how it happened, but you played that a good bit. And then you
it
played
like
every
punk
week.
Rock, days of punk rock. No one else would have the bands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so even though we were never, you know, full on punk rock in your face we were still put in that box and not let play anywhere and except this place called the Project Arts, and we played there and we broke out of there and we've had this. That's when I was 16 or 17 years old.
Was that the beginning of U2? Was that the band?
We were actually, yeah, no, but before even we played there, as our the first hype. Name was The Hype. Yeah. Long before we actually lived up to that, sadly. And it's a terrible thing to want to be.
But it was like, I remember, I often tell Bono that it was just one song, which I think they won. There's a magazine called the Hot Press Award. Was it you won that?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had seen them play, like, for about a year. And then they went away and wrote this song and a few others. And I remember coming into the project, and it's just like the Pied Piper. You hear this tone and a tune, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. It was a bit like listening to the Sex Pistols, but it wasn't that kind of aggressive. It was like Walk Away, was it?
I will follow.
Yeah, I keep saying Walk Away, but that's just
That was the whole idea of the song, actually, was to get people to do that, Jim.
But it's a great song even today, you know, which is weird the way when you put down something, even if it's like the earliest thing you do, sometimes it contains within itself like an embryonic form, stuff that you do much later. And that's kind of like With or Without You and a lot of other stuff you've done.
You know, people need that.
Only one idea, Jim.
People need that place, you know, to learn to be that you gave them.
Yeah.
Were you directing the theater then? Were you running it?
I was running it, yeah. You know, the theater then was like, it was very funny. It was like the maddest place in Dublin because it was, we brought over a group called Gay Sweatshop, and it was like the Stonewall riots and everything all rolled into one. It might even be hard to say on National Public Radio what the reviews were, but you can only imagine. And the county councillors would say to me, when are you getting those funny bunnies out of Dublin? And I'd be like, oh, man. And what was happening was that the rest of the politicians were going to Europe, and they were getting their head beaten by all the gay lobby in Europe and coming back and telling the county councillors to shut up. But the county councillors were thinking they're getting their votes by gay bashing. So the Lord Mayor, somebody stood up and he said, like, you know, the project have been very good in the past, and, you know, if they're good in future and they're more responsible, we'll give them back their money. And I burst in the doors, and there was two fellas with spears there from Cabra, I think, you know, like, it's just a part of Dublin, two old men who'd been standing in this chamber since 1922, you know, the foundation of the state, and there's this young fella running by them, you know, and they've spears and they didn't know what to do with them, and they tried to start stopping me with
these are the guards.
Yeah, the guards, yeah. And I walked up to the Lord Mayor and I said, no, we were responsible, so stick your money in. Ugh, that started a huge war, and then they had a quorum, they had a big meeting and whether they would give the money back, and one guy got up and said, which is my favourite quote, he said, so long as I'm alive and walk, it was Dunleary right down, he says, I'm walking the streets of Dunleary, there'll be no heterosexuals, homosexuals or lesbians on our stage. So we all start barking at him. Woo, woo.
Or dogs.
Yeah. Or dogs. It was like, man. And it, you know, so you had that kind of thing of where, you know, you two came out of it and Gabriel Bourne, Liam Neeson, me and my brother Peter, and it was just kind of like
Neil Jordan,
yeah. Neil was in a theatre group with me, which we went into the, and it was just an explosion that happens. There were many things about Ireland that were being discovered and discussed then, you know. It was kind of a redefinition of Ireland.
Let me just ask this. When you say you came out of this, in fact, you came out of it in terms of this movie, you actually physically came out of this and came to America.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is...
Yeah.
I don't know how much it is the story of your actually coming to America. I know that there's this character who has died in this family, and he's named for your brother who died.
Yeah. Well, in a way, when I was in America, you two came, and I went to see them out in the place out in New Jersey, Giant Stadium, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge gig, you know, and it was like, if you can imagine, the last time I saw these guys, I was in Dublin, and it was in the project, there's some small place like that, And this was a 50,000 seater more. And it was just like, oh my God, you know?
And did you have a job then? Were you working then?
No, I had a supposed job running a theater called the Irish Arts Center.
Yeah, but suddenly you know a famous rock star and you're...
Yeah, and you're like broke. And you're thinking, what am I doing in America? So, but for me, coming there was like, you know, there's a huge Irish anger within the Irish community in America, which sometimes has not been diverted the right way. And that anger kind of comes out of the famine, you know. And everywhere I go, people say, when are you going to do a film about the famine? And I say, when it won't make any more people angry. Because I'm not interested, that's not a journey that I think is the artist's journey.
Yeah.
I don't, like, I've never really, even though I've done political films, I haven't done them really to inflame passions. I've tried to do them to give what otherwise would be violence a voice. Because I think when you give people, violence is just language without articulation to me. It's just rage. So I think one of the jobs that we have to do is take that rage and it's like diffusing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you articulate it, you diffuse it. You know?
This film is so powerful in its feeling of family connectivity, in the absence of this character, Frankie, the love for him. That's your story. And I just think it would be very, very difficult to make a film like that, to make yourself that vulnerable, because it's your sadness that you're filming there, isn't it?
Yeah, to an extent. You know, my favorite painter is Van Gogh, and I became fascinated with people who had lost brothers or siblings or whatever, you know, like Terry Malick and Van Gogh and strange people that you wouldn't know, Joyce and Wilde and Yeats and Eugene O'Neill and Van Gogh as the prime one, because his situation was the brother was not only his brother but Carl Vincent, and his father was religious, was a pastor, and they lived beside the graveyard, so every day he saw Vincent on the tombstone. So I think he developed this ultra fascination with his brother, which was put into Theo, put into Gauguin, put into abandonment. And at the same time as there's abandonment, there's kind of the wish to be the dead child, because you know the dead child is loved. That's what seems to be his, to me, his story. So when you look at the Potato Eaters, which is a murky black picture with like Northern European landscape feel, it's technically quite, he was always technically good, but the mother is looking at the silhouette dead child. So it's always like the feeling to Van Gogh that the mother's looking over his shoulder at the dead child. So as he goes towards painting the beatific vision or painting the interior spirit, he's also going towards suicide. And that it's a conjunction of the love of the light and the love of the dark that makes his thing explode. And if you look at Gauguin's room, which he did, which is a painting of a bed and chair, nobody else would call it Gauguin's room. They go, still life, bed and chair. But he calls it what's not there. So therefore he's painting abandonment. He's painting an emotion. And it's very hard to do that because we always consciously want to show what we're trying to reveal. But sometimes it's better to hide what we're revealing. You know, sometimes it's better not to have it there. And I've become fascinated with the sense of invisibility in the images, the sense that it's the reduction of information that's most important.
How old were you when your brother died?
I was 17, he was 10. You know, it's kind of like, it's very odd because you're being asked all these questions all the time about yourself. And the weird thing was, when I came to do like the Late Late Show, which was the hour equivalent of Leno, I had stayed up the night before because I was touring around. I was really dehydrated because I drank a bit, and I didn't get up till about 4 p.m. because I didn't go to bed late. And so I had one of these situations where the gig is over at 11 and I drank till 8 and I was like out of it. So I went down to the steam room and I tried to steam out the alcohol so I could go on the telly, and that was the worst thing I could do because I was now really weak and kind of odd. And Bono walked by me and I literally an edge, and I thought, is this a dream? That's what I thought for a sec. Then they sat down and the guy said, so Jim, what do you think of Bono? And I'm like, because Edge was sitting beside him, I was thinking, well, it's like millions of things went through my head at once. It was kind of like, which is my brother? One of them's not here. I can't talk about Bono without talking about The Edge. I'm confused. And I couldn't say anything. And in my head, I was going, ask me a question about me, because I can answer me. I've been doing it for 3 months. You know? It's like, and it was so strange. And it worked very well, because I didn't come out with, like, you know, Bono has done this for Africa, and he's done that for whatever else, you know. Yeah. We all know that public story. And I just said, don't cross Bono, he's tough. And I thought that was quite accurate, you know what I mean? What do you think, Bonjo? Am I wrong there?
Jimbo reckons you know, the great student and fan of Martin Luther King is much more likely to give you a thump than people think. And that's probably why I wrote the song.
Yeah. You know, the actual thing with with that song, like, I was thinking about that and trying to put into musical terms what I'm thinking is visual terms. It's the rage in the piece. That's the power. You know, it's the level of ability in the rage, you know, that gives the...
In Pride in the Name of Love.
That yeah. But in any expression like that, Bono, in any expression of, like, this is about peace, so get your act together or we're going to kick your head in. You know, it's that... It's the restraint of the anger that's most important. I don't know. Anyway, this is NPR.
We'll go to commercials. Thank you.
This song has been nominated for a Golden Globe. You all must be waiting, hopefully, for... Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult for this song not to be lost. I mean, I'm used to this sort of big behemoth.
To be lost?
Big, you know, that U2's like a big monster that you can ride on the back of it. And so if you've got songs... You have a good chance of getting them out into the consciousness. However, I'm experiencing what a lot of my other friends, musicians, experience on a regular basis. You can write a great song, but if it's not, you know, out there on the radio, whatever, people could miss it. We're up against Lord of the Rings and all that money and all this. This is a small independent film, doesn't have any money. And so... You know, it's going to be difficult for the song to do well, and yet it's one of the things I feel, you know, it's one of the things I'm most proud of ever doing. And it's an interesting relationship, ours, mine and Jim's, and in fact, Gavin Friday and Morrissey's are kind of extraordinary in their own right. Score is extraordinary. So this is all going off, and I'm thinking, wow, unless we get those Academy nominations, probably people won't hear about this at all. And I'm... You know, probably because I am a little, I have a bit of the person Jim sees when he looks at me in me. I think, who do I kill around here? This is a beautiful song. Mm-hmm. But it's like you take off your rock star clothes and step into some overalls only to have somebody give you your union card and tell you you're fired. You know, that's what it's very, there's no power.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're working... In a film, and Jim gives you the power in as a creative thing, but you're part of. That's what I must. I mean, from your point of view, Jim, and actors, the surrender, the giving up of your own power into somebody's hands and to industry's hands. See, in the music, since I've been 20 years old, no one has ever told me what to do. Actually, it's my wife. there's Larry, Edge, Adam, and Anna. But apart from them. And Jim and Gavin. No, but, you know, I'm used to being in charge of my own destiny.
Yeah.
And I'm used to being able to look after those songs very jealously. And U2 is a great vehicle for our songs. And that's how I see it. I see it in an extraordinary opportunity. And I'm spoiled, is what I realize. And
but here, in this situation, maybe you're working more like an ordinary working guy and you've got collaborators and you've got you're not a star anymore.
I'm not a star anymore. What a relief.
Relief or disappointment?
What a relief.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that's... You don't invite humbling on yourself. You know, it's not a good thing to do. But when it happens, how you deal with it is very important, you know? And that it's like that for me with, you know, even getting my kids to write the script, they just eliminated my character, you know? So it's like, okay, I'm gone now. They rub me out and... It's about them. And I saw how much they had to suffer through coming to America, you know? And in a way, although there's a little bit of vulnerability when you write a story, I'm probably not aware of that, you know? I'm probably not aware of it, but I am aware of the sacrifices that they made and that that should be recorded, you know what I mean?
But what's striking about your film is that the dignity of working people in New York, as it happens in this case in Manhattan, and their generosity in getting out of the way of an Irish family that arrives. It's an amazing portrait of America right now at a time when people around the world are cynical about the United States.
They don't like the United States in a lot of places.
This is a beautiful portrait. I mean, there's the bureaucracy some people are banging their heads against. I mean, I've read reviews in Europe that have been critical of the film for that very reason, which is mad. Like
because when you watch this film, I mean, you just kind of deeply connect with, this is what I love about America.
That's it. And it's both of our experiences. Jim had poverty to deal with in America and overcame it, but his experience is one of great joy, and you know, he's in love with America, and the same for me. I didn't have that moment of poverty because I didn't have a family when I arrived. You know, as a kid, 19, you know, we were in our band, and it was just wow. And it didn't matter that we had no money. We just felt rich walking around the place, just to the eyes. And
well, the amazing thing I found about here was, I came from Europe. I was very left wing. I had done left wing theatre in England, and then I tried to start doing theatre here, and I would get Russians coming in saying, "How many stage managers do you have?" And I'd say, "None." And they'd say, "But how many do you have?" And I'd say, "None." They'd say, "We had 8 in Russia." And I was the director. I had 8 stage managers. And I'd be like, "Must be weird in Russia, you know?" And it was, I wouldn't say the left wing thing was completely beaten out of me, or the socialist thing, but it didn't happen through an intellectual process. It was by engaging in a real process that I began to go, "Oh my God, you know, that it can't all be in your head, you know." And it's like in Europe, I talked to all these lefties and up to 1989 or 90, and then one day the snow melted and the Berlin Wall came down. Nobody ever talked about the snow that had been there for 20 years. You know, the snow is like the Marxism, the safe covering of, once we're in Marxism, we can all pretend we're socialists, not do anything about it. And you know, what happened to me was that I would get in a cab and I'd say, "I'm 54th and 11th. And he'd take me to 54th and 11th. And I'd go, 51st. And he'd say, "Yeah, 54th. And I'd be like, "No, 51 and 11. And what happened in that little exchange, I realized, in the little interior change of making myself clearer, was that a shift in how I artistically tried to express myself came. I got simpler. I got more direct. And, you know, it's a great line of Einstein's. He said, "When I'm asking simple questions and getting simple answers, I'm talking to God." And there is something about that. That simplicity is the really difficult thing to get. So you have a situation where in the art form that is cinema, it is based to a large extent on the American cinema, which is based on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the feeling that everybody can be an individual. Now, that's worth expressing. That's one great side of the American project. And the other side of it is that all the European cultures in cinema keep getting battered by the power of the market. So there's a negative and a positive. So for me, trying to stride that kind of monster, I have to not do folk film. In other words, folk film is when you go to a preview, you get your response, you keep the response, and you keep making films like that. But because the film isn't about an American audience, you have to go under the folk tradition, back to another myth or something. And the film is really about the myth of leaving the dead behind, leaving the past behind, and coming to a new place. And America has been amazing to the Irish. Look, it's never been expressed what happened because everybody who came spoke Gaelic. So the first generation had no poets to record what happened. So in Ireland, the myth amongst the Pale dwellers, which are the people inside the British administration, which is the English language, which is Yeats and Joyce, the myth is that Joyce and Beckett, but Joyce was the first exile. Well, he wasn't. 1.5 million left before him to come here. But because there was no artist to record it, there was no sense within the DNA of, say, the race that it ever happened. So when you don't have that, you have an unexpressed anger, which will later come out. And I think you're only seeing the beginning of what's going to happen with the Irish expression within America.
Is that what we're seeing in with this the group of Dublin artists you're talking about who explode and come out in music?
Honest to God, and I'm not blowing smoke up Bono's ass just because you two were it. That was the first breakthrough. That was the first, and it was misinterpreted. Everybody thought the first song was like a rebel song. You know, Bono had to go out and say it's not a rebel song to get it in their head, you know, because it was deeper than that. You know, and so what will happen, hopefully, is that the melting pot that is America, you know, that is the Irish in America, which was JFK, which was city-based, which was America as non-isolationist. Well, that's what we want to celebrate, I think.
Jim Sheridan, director of In America, Bono, songwriter for In America. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.